Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to The Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode one of the team's latest series on The State vs. Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. Now, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation might not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening on. Our guests today are Robbie Ashadri. She is the lead investigator on this case and one of the hosts of Undisclosed. And if you don't know that by now, I think we should just introduce you like Cher, Robbie. It should just be Robbia.
Just Robbia. Or Chaudhry, whichever one you want to go with.
Well, we do have a really great guest with us today. It's Corporal Russell Benfield. Corporal Benfield began his career as a Mobile police officer in July of 1989. And after 10 years working various assignments within the Mobile Police Department, he transferred to the Identification Unit in 1989, where he worked as a crime scene investigator and fingerprint examiner until his retirement in 2015. Corporal Benfield was hired by the Mobile County Sheriff's Office Crime Scene Unit in January 2015, where he continues to work as a crime scene investigator and fingerprint examiner. Corporal Benfield, welcome to Undisclosed Addendum.
Thank you. It's good to be here, and I appreciate the invitation.
Well, I think you're going to have some really great observations about this case because the crime scene is very interesting. But I want to start with Robbia, and thanks for having me on this season of Addendum.
I'm so excited that you're hosting. Thank you, Kevin.
I have to ask, just, you know, not for nothing, why New Hampshire or New England? Why did you pick this region of the country? I asked because, of course, I'm from New Hampshire, and I know some of...
It was only so I could hang out with you and Rebecca. I
mean, oh, great, great. Yeah. Well, I figured as much, but is there a deeper reason?
There is a deeper reason, yeah. So a few years ago, the Innocence Project of New England reached out to me and said, you know, we've been following your work. We know that you guys work with different innocence projects across the country, and we have a case that we think would be great for you. They had kind of hit a dead end in it. And a lot of times when Innocence Projects reach out to us, many of them are they have very little resources. They don't have the resources to do a proper reinvestigation, look for every witness again, like, you know, the kinds of things we can bring. So I said, okay, let me take a look at this. And, they made their case to me. They laid out, you know, like these are all the different layers in the case. And I was just kind of fascinated. And after about 6 or 7 months, I was like, yeah, I think I want to take it. And so I committed to it about 2 years ago when I was wrapping up the Greg Lance case. And, as soon as I finished that up, I started reading the documents and diving deeper.
Russell, have you ever been to New England?
No, sir, I have not.
Oh, you have to make it a priority now. Come on.
My adventures north have been as far as New Jersey.
Well, that's not the place to start. You got to come up, especially this time of year.
It's definitely not the place to stop. No, you want to go further than New Jersey. But, you know, Kevin, let me ask and add one more thing.
Yeah.
Another thing that's compelling about this is what I learned about kind of the legal culture of New Hampshire. It's a very, obviously, you know, it's a very small state. The legal community is very close together. There's kind of this understanding that wrongful convictions don't happen here. And it might be because there's never been an exoneration to come out of New Hampshire.
Right. Yeah.
And so the prospect of that, I think, has been really fascinating.
Yeah. And it is, as you say, a tight-knit community, a legal community. And yeah, I think that does play a lot into it because there has not been sort of a cultural, professional precedent. And, you know, also the demographics of New Hampshire are very different than in some of these areas where you have covered before. And do you think that that's part of why even I think some defense attorneys say, well, there's no wrongful convictions here?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard defense attorneys actually say that it kind of doesn't happen here. Like, everybody does the right thing. And I don't doubt that people do the right thing thinking they're doing the right thing, but it doesn't mean that mistakes can't happen. I do think when you have a smaller town, you have a closer-knit community, it's harder to be confrontational with your colleagues and to say, no, I think there was either misconduct or you messed up. That's my guess. But in other places, the lines are much more clear between, like, you know, state and defense and police, and like the lines just seem much more clear. Where here, they seemed a little, in places where communities are smaller, they seem a little more blurred. Everybody knows everybody personally.
Russell, you have decades in law enforcement, and what is your perception of the idea of wrongful convictions or just bad investigations? I'm sure that you took a lot of professional care in the things that you did, but it seems like some in law enforcement just, or prosecutors, they just can't believe that mistakes could happen or malfeasance. What's your take on that when you hear people say, well, you know, this was a wrongful conviction?
Well, with the advances we have in our sciences nowadays with some of the wrongful convictions, you know, they are able to exonerate people based on some of the DNA technology that has advanced over the years. So, you know, I can see where that would help people to be able to clear their name.
So, Robbie, I want to start by episode one. I got to congratulate you and compliment you on the way you open episode one and open the series. And there are two things. So can your ego handle this?
I'm over here smiling. I'm like, listen, if I can get a thumbs up from you.
Yeah. All right, let's just talk about, there's sort of a prologue here that has to do with social media. And for those that listen to it, remember, it's about your, you know, most, I guess, popular tweet.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with crime or politics, but it really has to do with human behavior and emotions and stuff like that, which do play into the larger story of the case that we're going to get into throughout the season. So, you know, why did you want to start with this tweet?
I think one of the things that really drew me to the case is that central fact that I led to in the introduction, which was that Jason Carroll's mother was instrumental in getting the confession from him. But for her involvement, it might not have happened. I think it's highly likely it might not have happened. I mean, who knows? But she helped kind of cross that line, that finish line for the detectives. And but for the confession, he would not have been convicted, basically. That was the only evidence they had against him. And I think, and you know what that does to a family afterwards when the mother realized that she, what kind of a mistake she made. I mean, it's obviously would be devastating for any parent, but she really had faith in her colleagues. She was a police officer. She had faith in her son. She had faith in the system. And so just thinking about, and I'm a mother, I've got three kids. I'm like, it's hard for me to like understand even like how she must have lived with that in the last 31 years. And so I just wanted to start off by sharing something that seemed to resonate across the internet with parents everywhere. Just to tap into that kind of parental emotion of what we wouldn't do for our kids.
Yeah, Russell, I don't know if you have kids, but, you know, as a dad myself, I can really see myself trying to be protective at all costs to my kids, no matter what kind of trouble they're in. And, you know, I can also see myself saying, you know, you've got two bad choices, go this way, and thinking it's the lesser of two evils. On a personal level, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I have raised four children, and the youngest being 32 years old now.
You must have started when you were 12, right?
No, my son was born, or my youngest son was born in 1989, shortly after I began my police career.
Uh-huh. And, you know, as a dad with a badge, did you feel like, you know, I've got to make sure that my kids stay out of trouble, and when they do something a little wrong, that's maybe it's a little different because, you know, you're doing what you can to be seen as a, you know, leader in your community.
Right, and, you know, it's kind of like the old story about the preacher has the worst kids. You know, cops' kids are generally try to take advantage of their parents' authority, even like when they get pulled over for a traffic ticket or something. They're really quick to throw dad's name out there.
Yeah, I bet. And we laugh, but this is actually a really, this is not conversational. This is a really important part of this season that I think listeners are going to come to remember as we go forward. Now, the other part, Robbie, I wanted to compliment you on about this episode and the way you start is that after you have this anecdotal thing about parents, you tease a confession scene, and then we don't hear anything more about it. I'm teased, and we go away from it, and we start with chapter one. And I really feel like that is how one would start an old school true crime book, like the kinds I've written, but only better.
So listen, I learned my lesson. I remember, I'm just going to put it out there, when I did the Greg Lance case and episode 9, I'm like, here's the suspects. And I remember you and Rebecca were both like, why did you guys wait so long? I was like, you know what? I'm just going to kind of, and I realized, like, you know, better storytelling, it's a better way to tell a story is to just kind of like, you know, put that up front. So people know what to look forward to, that there's something like that that's tremendous going to happen. That's, to me, that's really the heart of the story is what happened in that interrogation room with Jason Carroll and his mother. And so I just learned my lesson from fantastic storytellers like you and your wife.
Oh, well, thank you for that. But it's all you. I think it's also very difficult. And, you know, your longtime fans can appreciate this. The balance between doing advocacy and investigation and telling a compelling story, because sometimes you go really deep in the weeds on certain issues. If we don't find this story interesting, we're not going to stick with you.
And 100%, yeah.
Over the years, you've been able to do that.
Lawyers aren't so great at it. You know, and so it's been a steep learning curve, but 6 years in, we're getting a little bit better.
Where we start, really, is we start 1988. It's the murder of Sharon Johnson, of Beau. She was 7 months pregnant. She left work one evening, and she never made it home. Her body was found the next day at a construction site. And as we go through this, you start off with this, you know, I think a very vivid scene of the first person to come across the body, and he's driving some heavy machinery. I think it was an excavator or something like that.
Yeah, he was hauling an excavator up this incline. It's like a gravel road into a new construction site.
Yeah, a housing development there. And he found the body. And also, sort of, you know, the first time investigators get to the crime scene, there's been a lot of activity already. I think machinery drove over some blood or... You know, it seemed like some of the stuff was scrambled here. Is that true?
Yeah, so the way it seems to have gone down is as he was kind of coming up this incline and like the road curved a little bit and he stopped the machine, he ended up stopping it over this, like kind of this the center of this little area that was an open construction area that kind of looked like a shape like a circle. And on one end, like in front of him would have been like this shallow pond that they were building themselves. To the left of him were a bunch of these big piles of sand. And he stopped the excavator because he thought he saw something. And as he stepped down, he was like, wait a minute, there's all these big... I really have rolled over this whole area of a ton of scuffing. It looks like either a bunch of deer went through. Something happened here. Mm-hmm. And then he went to go look because he thought he saw a dummy. And when he realized it was a body, then he got really careful. And he walked back carefully. He didn't step into any of the scuff marks. He gets to the excavator and it has those big... treads, right? So he stands up, he actually climbed up on there to make sure he doesn't disturb the scene any further. And that's, but before he does that, he leans down and he sees that, oh crap, there's actually some evidence underneath it. There was like a shoe stuck underneath one of the treads. He saw a big pool of blood. None of that he touched or moved until the police got there though.
Russell, that's got to be a really bad break. You know, if you came across a scene and all of a sudden, you know, there had been big equipment that came through and went through a lot of the footprints and other stuff that was there. I mean, I think you'd be really disappointed, right?
Yes, and I've worked on cases similar to that in many situations where, you know, it's unfortunate, but it does happen. And, you know, it seems like the operator of the excavator, once he realized the body was there, he didn't go back and try to remove the excavator. He left it in place, which would have been an added bonus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you had been on a scene like that and you've got a body that's probably been out overnight and you know, it's undeveloped, what would you be doing first?
Well, at any crime scene, the first thing you want to do is document it with photographs as you arrive. You know, and then you're going to start identifying pieces of evidence, putting some markers down to make sure nobody else is going to step on them or kick them, move them. You know, and from there, you'll go into photography documentation and then diagramming where all these items are.
What does the location, Robbie, say to you of the crime scene? Because, again, it's not in the middle of the woods. It's not in an alley or somebody's basement. It is a place that's remote, but it's not woods. It's the beginnings of a construction development. So it's isolated, yet there's room to have a fight or whatever. What does it tell you that this is the place that this went down?
It actually, this development was being built, like they were clearing woods to build it. So really it was surrounded by woods. The development only had, I think at the time the murder took place, the foundation of the very first home. So like nothing had been built yet other than the, maybe just the foundation, the beginnings of the first home. And that property had started, what was being built, not up by where the pond was, but at the beginning of the gravel road going up, which of course was later paved when the community was ready. But
like a spec so home, right?
Well, I don't know if it was a spec home or if it was something that was actually had been sold or something. But it was, by the time the trial rolled around, that home was built. Actually, even a year later, by the time we had the confession and charges came, that home had been built and people were living in it, I believe. So, but at that time, there was nobody living there. Okay, so this is a place that, I mean, there's only two, this is not like a place where the victim is kind of happens to be wandering by herself and mm-hmm. gets jumped. Right, she had to have been taken there is what it says to me, because it's not on a main road. You have to kind of either know the location or you're somebody who's kind of driven around and found a remote location, right? Like those are the two things. But I actually be more interested in hearing what Russell has to say about that, because especially because a couple of days after the murder, there was a newspaper article in which construction workers who were interviewed said that, listen, this couldn't have been random. Like somebody had to know this area to bring her here. Like nobody even knows this construction site exists type of thing.
Yeah, Russell, what do you think about that? Did that raise a flag to you?
Yeah, and that's kind of my opinion also, is that, you know, most of the time when you're going to do something like that, you're going to be familiar with the area because it's your comfort zone. You're not going to go somewhere where you're uncomfortable, because that would just increase your chances of getting somewhere and getting stuck, or maybe a dead-end street where you have no escape. So somebody would probably be familiar with that area.
Yeah, I agree. It certainly reads like the person or persons knew that there was enough privacy there that they could, you know, do what they wanted to do, but it isn't an obvious place. By the way, do you know why there was so much construction going on in southern New Hampshire at that time?
Do you?
Well, of course I do. Come on. That's the only reason you have me on.
You tell us.
Okay. So in 1988, Money Magazine named Nashua, New Hampshire, the number one place to live in the country.
Oh.
And this is just at the time that the economy starting to grow again. And so there's this flood of money for housing. And so there are developments all over the place. Bedford is slightly farther away. It's probably about 15 minutes away from Nashua. But that whole southern New Hampshire area just started to grow. And then at this time, they're putting in new highway exits because of the volume. It really was the start of growth. So the idea that there's a construction site, it wasn't at the time, it wasn't unique, because they were going up all over the place because of the increasing demand. So when you said, you know, at this time, like, yeah, that makes sense to me that they would just be starting to do site work about this time because financing's coming in and there's all this demand.
Right.
So see, I'm going to have a little stupid bits of trivia about New Hampshire.
No, that actually... I mean, it's so helpful to me, because to me what that means is like, okay, unless I'm in the construction industry, I'm not going to exactly know what sites are going up and where, right? Or right. I'm looking to buy. Like, it's going to be one of those things. Otherwise, I might generally know there's a lot of building happening. I mean, where I live right now, there's a lot of building happening. I don't know exactly where the sites are. To me, that makes it even more more obvious that this is somebody who just kind of knew that this was a place that was like, it was remote enough that there's nobody actually living there yet. It's that new, right? Yeah. Like, so I actually, another thing, a question that was raised by somebody, and I really want to ask Russell, is that, and I thought this was really interesting, and it was raised in one of the newspaper articles. Again, somebody was like, it's so strange to me that it was surrounded by woods, right? But the person left the body right there, like kind of out in the open, and they easily could have dragged her like 10 or 15 feet and her body would have been in the woods and been harder to find. What does that say to you, Russell, with your experience that was not done?
Well, from reading the report, I saw where there may have been scuffle marks underneath the excavator where maybe an indication that a fight or altercation had occurred there, and that the body had been moved about 20 feet or so, maybe drug. And, you know, sometimes people will plan their attack, and where they fail to complete is by not planning the follow through. You know, they plan the homicide, but they may not plan the disposal or the, you know, what they do after the homicide has occurred. But what I saw in this case with the 20 foot of drag marks, part of the story was about a witness and his wife going to check on a piece of property late in the evening and may have disturbed a car that was parked back there. So
yeah.
If they were in the process of maybe dragging the body to a more heavily wooded area, that it might have gotten interrupted, and they could have fled shortly after the witnesses drove through.
You know, yeah, Russell, one of the things that tells me, absolutely, the people or the person or people could have been scared off by somebody coming in and they didn't finish their process of hiding the body. And we know that Sharon was 150 pounds and she was pregnant. So I have done cases where the female victim was heavy set and was... her body was hard to move. A body is, you know, it's not like picking up your kids when they're sleeping and putting them to bed. It's a very cumbersome thing to move. And when two people do it, it seems like if there were two people that were going to move the body, one could get under the armpits, the other could pick up the legs, and the body would never drag, right? You would just carry. The drag mark to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, kind of indicates one person who tried to pull the body and maybe just gave up because they were too tired. It was too cumbersome. Am I crazy?
I can see that. I mean, two people could drag as well as carry. So kind of hard to say without having a little further information on that. But, you know, I'm under the impression that they were definitely going to move the body away from where the altercation had occurred, you know, maybe to try to bury it or put it in a more heavily wooded area.
She was tall too. She was 5'7". She wasn't, you know what I mean? For a woman, that's a pretty good height. And so I agree with you. Probably it was just like, at some point it's like, I can't, like, how do you move somebody, a body of that size, easily? It would be really hard.
150 pounds of dead weight that's quite a package to have to drag.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I have been told by pregnant women that their bodies do not, are not equally balanced anymore. So I can imagine that, you know, also carrying a child, you know, also does things to the way that weight is distributed. And you're right. It doesn't seem like an easy task. Now, Robbie, you include, and you don't always do this, you include some important details from the autopsy. Probably, I don't want to say more graphic, but certainly more detailed than I think most undisclosed listeners have come to know. Can you explain that decision?
Yeah, I think, the autopsy, the body itself is contains evidence, right? I mean, like these wounds, the injuries here are evidence. And the way that she was attacked, she had one stab wound in her back, 13 in the front. Her injuries to her hands, which were defensive wounds, shows that she was fighting back. She bit off part of her own tongue, trying to probably breathe as she's being strangled. It just tells you kind of a little bit about what happened, in terms of, like, you know, it wasn't like she was knocked out and killed, right? She was conscious. She was fighting back. But also, you know, and my investigator who worked with me on this case, Sarah Kalin, in fact, who is the one who referred Russell to us, she said, you know, there's even some research that tells you that when you have a stabbing murder, that in and of itself as a method of killing somebody tells you something, you know, that it's probably a personal thing. Number one. Number two, the number of times a woman is stabbed or a victim is stabbed, if it's, I think, above 9 is what Sarah Kalin said to me, then it indicates maybe some kind of a sexual motive underneath it. So I think there are clues to be found in that. The stab wounds themselves, the angles of them, we're going to get more into that when we look more closely at the evidence. The angles of it, the depths of the wounds are very, very important to the case because of, you know, determining what possibly the murder weapon could be. Which actually gets to one of the talking points here. And I know, Kevin, you're like, but I, like I said, I have questions for, this is one of my questions that I keep asking investigators who have worked this case to tell me what they think. And I'd love to ask Russell. The medical examiner said that the wounds look like they were made by a utility knife. And I'm trying to understand what that means in law enforcement, to a law enforcement officer, or I even spoke to one of the forensic folks at New Hampshire lab. But what does that mean to you? What does a utility knife mean to you, Russell?
Well, one or two things come to mind when you say utility knife. There's the retractable blade, what most people refer to as a box cutter or a carpet cutting knife. The other thing referred to as a utility knife has a fixed handle, and it usually has like a hook kind of blade on it. So, depending on the, you know, the coroner would be able to look at these and, you know, pretty much tell if it was one of the box cutter type of knives by the shape of the blade and the insertion.
Yeah. So the autopsy report says that, you know, it looked like it was a blade that had one sharp edge and one dull edge, which sounds a little bit like a box cutter. I don't think there's any indication in the autopsy that there was any kind of hook towards the end. But here's what I'm wondering. I mean, can you stab somebody with a box cutter? I thought you can just kind of slice across. Can you actually stab into a body with a box cutter?
You could. Just
but not very deep, though, right?
How you're swinging it.
The blade is not terribly long. It's not like a kitchen knife or something, though, right? Depending on, you know, obviously what utility knife we're talking about.
Yeah, there's various lengths on some of the blades. Some of these disposable utility knives, you can actually extend the blade out several inches rather than just the typical carpet-type knife where you have to take the knife apart to change the blade. Those, I would think the blade there is only about an inch and a half in length.
Right, right. You know, Russell, Robbie brought up a good point about the method of death. There's two things in the attack. There's the multiple stabbings and the strangulation, and both of those are rather intimate kinds of attacks. And right?
Yeah, those are, you know, knife fights or knife wounds are generally up close and personal. And you know, anytime you see multiple stab wounds, generally, that's somebody who's pretty angry, has a lot of aggression, that would stab multiple times.
Yeah, and I bet also that when you're stabbing and there's a lot of blood, that the blade gets very slippery. And it's very easy for the assailant to cut the inside, that as they're holding the knife and they push it in, that their hand could slide off the handle and get caught on the blade. And that's, I think, oftentimes, Russell, that you'll find that an assailant will have wounds on their hand that they probably got by accident from the murder weapon.
Yes, I have seen cases where, stabbing cases, where the assailant has actually cut his own hand because of the body fluids on the knife being rather slippery.
Robbie, are investigators under the belief that Sharon died where her body was found? That they're pretty convinced that she wasn't taken someplace in a trunk of a car or something like that?
So what's interesting is that there was like an initial set of investigators in this case. And those are the reports that we're basing these first early episodes on. And then there'll be a new team that comes in later. This initial set of investigators actually seem to believe that maybe she had been attacked somewhere else, either killed or not killed, but attacked somewhere else. Maybe the car was brought to that location, her body taken out of a trunk and then dragged to where it was eventually found. But later investigators believe that she actually was attacked and killed right there. Just given the amount of blood that was found, like under the excavator, one of the pools of blood was like 2 feet across. It's to me, I mean, I could be wrong, but it to me, it seems like maybe that's where like the initial attack actually happened, with that much blood loss and then continued blood loss found like in the drag marks and then where the body was found. But let's ask the expert. What do you think, Russell?
Well, from what I saw at the scene, when I looked at the diagram, there were tire tracks that was a short distance from where the excavator was parked. Yep. And there wasn't any indication that the tire tracks were up close to the excavator other than the tracks of the equipment itself. So the dump theory, seems like the tire tracks would be really close to where the jewelry and the shoe was found under the excavator with the blood. You know, the tire tracks should have been a lot closer there. If it was a dump site. So
that's a great point.
I kind of feel like the altercation may have occurred there.
Yeah.
Now, in the story, you know, we know that it's the state versus Jason Carroll. And I have already praised you for keeping the character of Jason Carroll out of the frame just temporarily. I know there are people who say, give me it all at once. But I'm going to say, no, you're doing a great job by drawing me in. But we do learn an awful lot about Sharon's husband, Ken, and where he was and what he said the day that her body was discovered. So, Robbie, walk us through briefly the phone calls and what he was communicating with Sharon's friends or coworkers and authorities.
Yeah, so the way it kind of went down was Thursday, July 28th on 1988, Sharon left work around a little after 6 p.m., between 6 and 6:30. She didn't make it home that night. Ken was awoken the next morning, he says, by these phone calls from a colleague of Sharon's who said, and it was like, I think, close to maybe 9 or something. Yeah, close to 9 when the colleague called, because Sharon usually got in there pretty early, 7 o'clock she was there. And she's like, well, she hasn't come in. Is she there? And he was very nonchalant. Anyhow, this woman called him like 6 times. And at some point, I think after the 3rd or 4th call, Ken finally agreed to call the police. She had been saying, you need to call the police. Something's wrong. Because if she's not there and she hasn't made it to work, something's wrong. So he calls the police around 10. And we're going to learn a lot more about him in episode 2 when we pick it up from when the investigators first show up to take a missing persons report, which happens at noon that day. That later becomes, they're there as to take a missing persons report. That later becomes obviously like a homicide investigation when they realize that that's his wife they found this morning. They haven't connected the cases yet. And so that's kind of like the timeline of how things took place. And Ken basically just said, well, you know, I waited for her last night. I went out for a little bit. I waited for her last night and I fell asleep. and she didn't come home. Or maybe she did, and maybe she came home and left earlier before I woke up, because she leaves pretty early.
Russell, when you're looking at, I don't want to, we'll just say a suspect. Everybody, I guess, is a suspect. And certainly if a pregnant woman is murdered, her husband would certainly be somebody you'd be looking at. Which do you give more weight to? The way that he is acting, because it's certainly not the way I would act, but that's something, you know, that we can debate, or what he is saying?
Yeah, what he's saying sounds a little evasive through the conversations with the lady, the coworker. And, you know, if I'm with you, if it's my wife, we're expecting a child, I'm going to know her schedule. I'm going to be a lot more attentive, you know, so I don't see the evasiveness in that situation.
Yeah, Robbie, we've talked historically that, you know, we sometimes put too much weight on the way a person acts after a homicide because people act differently. And,
sure.
You know, there's a famous podcast that you might have heard of about somebody that, you know, didn't act as sad as everybody thought he should have when he heard, you know, this horrible news and it was used against him. But you did find some discrepancies, or at least you pointed them out, in what Ken Johnson was saying, particularly about his communication with police.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree with what Russell just said. It's not so much about how he's saying it, but about what he's saying. And, you know, what we're talking about is when he's calling the police at 10 o'clock and telling them a certain story, this is like in the hours, like maybe hour and a half or so after the coworkers called him. So it's not like there's been a long enough time for him to forget details. Literally, this is all happening that morning within a matter of 2 hours max, right? So I can't say that anybody in that situation, for him to say, well, I called the New Hampshire police already. That's what he told the local police department. And he had not. He called them afterwards. I mean, that's just, as he's telling the police, he's telling a lie, right? So the question is, in that moment, it's not like he forgot. Did I call the New Hampshire police like this morning in the last hour and a half? He didn't forget. He's telling a lie. And the question is, why is he lying about that? With Carlene Webb, it was kind of the same thing. He told her, he just kept his stories, just even in those couple of, between those two or three phone calls, is so muddled about when he called. He also later will tell the police that within hours, again, of all of this happening, that morning he got up and he went for a drive to look for her. Except when Carlene called, he never said any such thing. He never said he went to look for her, right? So this is kind of like just the beginning of his story really not adding up. And to me, these are deliberate. They're not mistakes. He's deliberately telling lies.
Can I ask a question that a listener asked on Twitter? This is from Sarah. She asks, was it common for her to come home so late and then leave so early that he didn't see her? If he claims this, was it corroborated by anyone else besides him?
So according to Ken, Thursday nights was like a shopping night. She would hang out with a friend. It has not been corroborated by that friend ever that was a thing. Common for her to come home late, only according to Ken, that she did that sometimes. Everybody else that was interviewed, and even I've spoken to in the last year and a half, has said Sharon just went to work and went home. Like, she was pretty reliable. Like, her schedule was reliable. She's also 7 months pregnant. She's worked all day.
She's not going clubbing.
She's not going clubbing or to the bars. Like, what's she going to do?
Yeah.
So it doesn't really hold water for me. I'm not saying that there was never times when, but let's say she loved to shop at the local mall. The local mall is also going to close by either 8 or 9. 9
oh, yeah.
Latest. It's not going to be open until 11, you know. So how late could she be out?
I can also tell you that in 1988, there was not a lot of nightlife in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Honest to God, yeah. Up until, I don't know, the mid-80s, the liquor laws were you couldn't pick up your drink and move to another part of the, like, you couldn't carry your alcohol around. It was not a fun place. So, yeah, you're right. There's just nothing to do after 9 o'clock.
And so, she actually had to be, some of the work she was supposed to wrap up that evening, she wasn't able to get to. And she told one of the coworkers that I will be here extra early in the morning to get to it, like around 6:30. To me, that So to me, that doesn't scream like I'm going to be out all night and then I'm going to come, you know, and then I'm going to go to work really early. Like, I just can't imagine. I've been pregnant 7 months three times. So I know how that feels. And it's unlikely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because I was wondering why the first phone calls about where is she were coming in at 8:45.
Yeah.
Which still seems early for the workday, that, you know, a coworker would panic about that. But if you're actually now 2 hours late, then I can see why you might, you know.
Yeah. She normally got there around 7. She had said she'd be there half an hour early, like at 6:30.
Yeah. So we have another question, and it's from Darla. Were they having marital problems? He seems pretty unconcerned about the whereabouts of his pregnant wife or her safety or the safety of his unborn child. And then, was the baby his? What do you got for me, Rabia?
Well, I mean, the baby was definitely his. I don't even want to, like, you know, entertain that kind of a thing. The baby was definitely his. They wanted a baby. She had gotten a tubal ligation years earlier because she didn't want to have any more children. And then in this marriage, they decided they wanted, so she had to have it reversed. You know, they spent money and effort getting it reversed so they could have a baby together. They had children from different relationships, but they didn't have one together. As far as the marital problem issue, we're actually going to get into that in episode 2. So I'm going to keep you waiting on that one.
Yeah, I mean, without it saying anything towards, again, specifically to this case, Russell, you know that statistically speaking, one of the most dangerous times for a woman is, you know, when she is pregnant. That as far as when crimes are perpetrated against her by a loved one, that's often the triggering event. Just looking at the stats, right?
Yeah, I could see where, you know, they would consider her being defenseless, more or less.
Yeah, and not everybody reacts well to having a baby, but it sounds like, you know, this, if you're going through the trouble of having medical procedures, that that maybe both parties are committed to the idea of having a child, but as we've seen, you know, not every father to be is. Robbie, another question here. This one's from Evan. He says, I'm starting to suspect the husband was involved. Am I getting warm?
I mean, really, I feel like that's more of a comment, and I'll say, Kevin, you're nice and toasty, Evan. Look, I mean, like, I understand that, you know, it makes sense. Statistically, you start with the people who are closest to the victim, in this case, the husband. But also, Ken is not making it easy to eliminate him at this point, and then it's going to get even harder as it goes along. But I don't consider this a murder mystery. You know, that's where I stand on this case. It's not a mystery to me. And by the end of the season, I'm sure it won't be to others either, like what actually happened to Sharon.
One last question from social media. Becky asks, how do you know the exact times of the phone calls between Carlene and Ken and the police? Where are you getting that from?
We have call records. So we have all the call records from digital that Carlene made from her desk phone. So we know exactly what time she made the calls. We have reports with a transcript of Ken's call to the Bow police to call it in. So the transcript has a timestamp on it. We know what time he made the call. And then there's a report written by a state trooper that shows what time he called the state police. So it's all in, you know, the records. I mean, like, there's no kind of disputing that. I know that was our last question, but is it okay if I ask some questions of Russell before we let him go? Yeah, I want to go back to the crime scene, and I have a couple questions about this for you, Russell. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about the crime scene is that, okay, her shoes are off. That makes sense. At least one shoe is off. That makes sense. The struggle. Her watch is off. Again, that makes sense. She 3 rings from her fingers are also found. Also, you know, and her glasses can come off easily. I'm like, my rings are pretty snug on my finger, but it's the same to you that those rings also could have come off in the struggle, or somebody else was somebody else I was talking with thought, well, maybe like she took them off herself as like an offering, like, don't hurt me and I'll give these to you type of thing. Like, what does that say to you about the rings being off?
Yeah, I found that kind of odd also. The, you know, under the, what I was saying, the perpetrators may have been spooked and fled prematurely of completing their mission. I mean, if you're going to try to stage a scene to look like a sexual assault or something like that, then you are a robbery. You would take that jewelry with you and dispose of it elsewhere, not there at the scene. So, and I really don't see ring jewelry falling off unless it was extremely loose. So, I mean, possibly could have been removed by whoever did this. Yeah, why it was left at the scene, you know, that's another thing.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
Russell, was there anything else in the reports that you saw that maybe didn't make it into the podcast that you thought were significant or interesting?
Not right offhand. Like I say, I think y'all covered the phone records pretty good. Some of the witness statements from the people that lived up the road that saw the car, I believe the car stopped in somebody's driveway, and they even drew a sketch of what the front of the headlights looked like. And the only difference from the car they drew, I think it was the person who saw the car down at the lot where the body was, described it as a red vehicle, and I think the other car was described as blue. So a little discrepancy there in the description of the vehicles. Was it the same vehicle? Not sure. But and then the crime scene, it seems like the state police and the first responders done a terrific job of securing that scene and the documentation of it.
Yeah, they did. They did.
My whole journalistic career just about is in New Hampshire, and those are the only police reports I've ever seen. I always thought that the officers do a really good job of capturing stuff, and they're well written and informative. Robbie, you've looked at police reports from all over the country. I mean, are these pretty good?
Oh, these are, I mean, I think they did a fantastic job. And there is, I mean, as we move on, there are aspects to this investigation that they were so dogged in. They just did so much of, just so diligent in, like, you know, just trying to track down leads. They really did a tremendous job. I mean, the discovery file is where I have most of these documents, and they did a great job. There were some oversights, however, I'll say, but we'll get to those later too. A couple of glaring ones to me. But in this case, I, you know, documented the crime scene so great. It was so that they did. It's like almost 100 pages worth of just that. And you know, listing out all the evidence that's collected. One of the things I want to mention, in response to what Russell just said about the one report he's talking about, there were maybe at least half a dozen reports by different people who saw cars in the area. I did not include every single one, because some of them I think might not have been relevant. The only one that, the one that I included of like Nancy Skull, I think her last name was, I mean, that was them actually at the crime scene, right? Like they were there where the body was found the next morning. The other ones are like down the street and they were like later times. So I didn't include every single one because they didn't all kind of like, there was one report where somebody saw a truck with three or four people and a girl was screaming and they're fighting or something. Like, you know, they all didn't kind of line up. So I didn't include every single one because I didn't want it to get too muddled right now. I thought the most important one was the one of the family that was actually at the crime scene at the time that we think the murder took place, around that time. That was in the time frame of the murder taking place. And then the second report of the jogger, who I'm pretty sure saw the same car around the same time. The issue of the car, the color of the car is interesting, because Nancy and her husband, who were both there at the same time, saw the same car, but saw like two different things. Her husband said he thinks he saw a darker colored Blazer, which is a much bigger car. And she thinks she saw a red car that was small. And they're telling this report the very next day. So it's not like lots of time has passed, but it's a construction site. There is no light. As far as I know, there was some cloud cover that night. So it's got to be pitch black and maybe just their headlights. And I want to like do this experiment at some point with my husband, go into the woods and see if I can, or go somewhere remote where there's like no light, but it's hard to find a place like that where there's like the actual no artificial lighting.
Yeah, dark vehicle, but that's about it. I'm really shocked that eyewitness testimony might be contradictory.
Yeah,
that never
shocking,
happens.
Huh?
Well, before I ask Rabia to give us a preview of episode two, I want to first say, Russell, I thought you were a great guest. And before we started, you told us that you did have some radio experience as a younger person. Tell us about that.
Well, right out of high school, I took a job at a radio station. It played really old country music. I was an overnight DJ, so the hours were really long and hard to stay awake, but it was an interesting experience. Obviously, I wasn't great at it because I no longer do that for a living.
Well, broadcasting's loss is our game because, hey, you know, it may be great that you were spending all my exes live in Texas, but I think you found your calling here. Rabia, very quickly, give us a tease of what we're going to hear in episode two.
Well, you know, I mean, I teased it at the end that, you know, that basically we're going to go through the rest of that day. A lot happens in that day that they find the body. Ken Johnson is going to be interviewed like three different times over the course of the day. And then the investigation itself, obviously, at the crime scene is also continuing. So we're just going to kind of like chronologically keep following what happens. And he wasn't the only one home that night. You know, he had a couple daughters at home. So we're going to just start kind of moving chronologically through these first three or four days that were really important in trying to understand where everybody was that night.
Rabia Chaudhry, thank you so much for taking the time to bring us up to date on the next season here of Undisclosed.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Russell.
Hey, Corporal Russell Benefield from Mobile, thank you for joining us today. If you have any questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Mithil Telhan and Colin and Robbie and Susan for letting me be a part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.